are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. If you like what you hear, log into iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. If you're interested in sponsoring this podcast, email us at info@starlegacyfoundation.org. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Mana Parast, Associate Professor at UC San Diego School of Medicine. Dr. Parast's laboratory is interested in the development and function of the placenta as a unique organ essential for proper fetal development. Her clinical focus is on gynecologic and perinatal pathology and the changes in placentas in cases of perinatal morbidity and mortality. I spoke with Dr. Parast about stem cell research, cord issues, autopsies, and more. Well, Dr. Parast, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
My first question for you is just a general question. Can you tell us a little bit about your latest work at the UC San Diego School of Medicine?
Sure. So the big focus of our lab right now is to develop stem cell models for studying pregnancy complications. And in particular, we focus on pregnancy complications that originate from problems in the development of the placenta. So these include complications like recurrent miscarriage, preeclampsia, intrauterine growth restriction, or IUGR, and stillbirth. So the problem with many of these complications is that their origin is early in pregnancy, when the placenta is just developing. And here the development of the placenta is thought to be compromised, resulting in a condition that's generally referred to as placental insufficiency. But because we can't access the placenta during an ongoing pregnancy, it's very hard to know what exactly happened during these individual pregnancies that then resulted in a small placenta, small baby, a preterm baby, or a stillborn baby. But one thing that we can do is to use this novel stem cell strategy that's called reprogramming. This technique was developed by a Japanese scientist, Dr. Yamanaka, about 10 years ago. So this is where you take an adult cell. So for example, we can do a biopsy from your skin and isolate skin cells, fibroblasts actually. And you can introduce 4 genes into these cells. These 4 genes are sometimes referred to as Yamanaka factors, after Dr. Yamanaka. And over a period of a few weeks, these cells turn into cells that for all practical purposes behave as embryonic stem cells. But instead of being derived from an embryo, they were made from adult cells. And so these are referred to as induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells. And just like embryonic stem cells, iPS cells can be turned into any cell type in the humans. So, and this can be done in the dish, including placental cells. So iPS cells carry the genes from the individual that they were derived from. So, for example, if you carry a gene that predisposes you to Alzheimer's disease, heart disease, or placental disease, this can be studied in the dish. So we're taking cells from placentas at delivery and reprogramming them into iPS cells. And now we have these cells from both normal placentas and from placentas from pregnancies that are complicated with preeclampsia, for example. And now we're just starting to look and see where there are differences between how these iPS cells, for example, iPS cells from preeclampsia placentas develop into the placenta versus iPS cells from normal placentas.
That is fascinating. So what stage are we at with this reprogramming? How much is it being implemented here in the U.S. and around the globe?
You know, in terms of applications for placental disease, there's really only 2 labs in the U.S. that are doing this. And I even want to say it's just these two labs, ours and the lab of Dr. Michael Roberts at the University of Missouri. We're the only two labs that I know of that are using this method. I think the publications that have come from our two labs have recently pushed some other labs to start to develop similar methods. But so far, these are our two labs are the only two labs that are using this method to apply to learning about placental disease.
So for people who are listening to this podcast who are lay people who don't have a very common understanding of the medical field, what does this all mean? How groundbreaking does this reprogramming, how groundbreaking does this have the potential to be?
So, you know, if you look at other areas that this technology has been applied to, Alzheimer's disease is an example. It has a lot of potential. Basically, a lot of diseases, you know, similar to placental insufficiency, have, you know, it's known that, you know, a lot of disease predisposition comes from the genes that we carry. But it's also then the exposure to the environment, you know, it's that interaction between our genes and the environment that leads to disease. And so what iPSL technology provides us is the ability to study the person's genes, but then you can also, because you have these cells in a dish, you can expose them to various different kinds of environments that you think, for example, would contribute towards development of a particular disease. As an example, with placental disease, the disease preeclampsia is thought to develop in an environment of low oxygen. So one of the things that we're trying out with iPS cells that we have established from placentas of patients with preeclampsia, we're taking those cells and we grow them in the dish under either conditions of low oxygen or high oxygen. And we're actually seeing that at least some of the abnormalities that typically are expected to be seen from placental cells with preeclampsia, some of these only come about under conditions of low oxygen. So these iPS cells are really powerful because, again, you can study this sort of gene-environment interaction at a really great detail and really figure out how disease comes about. So this has been done, as I mentioned, this has been applied to other diseases like Alzheimer's disease. Actually, the director of our stem cell program, Dr. Larry Goldstein, studies Alzheimer's disease using a combination of iPS cells and other models. And one of the things that he and other stem cell researchers have been able to also do with these iPS cell models is to use them as a platform for drug screening, because people might know that for many of these diseases, there are animal models, and a lot of drugs are initially tested in animal models, but one, that ends up being very expensive, and you can't really test a large number of drugs on animal models. It takes, of course, you know, large number of animals to test a large number of drugs. Whereas these cells, these iPS cells, you can grow millions of them, billions of them in culture. And so screening drugs and screening, for example, a library of 100,000 small molecules or drug libraries becomes really easy to do with cells. And people are also finding that actually drug screening using iPS cells, because these are human cells, is actually not only more cost efficient, but the drugs that you identify actually have a higher level of efficacy because, again, you're testing them in a human model as opposed to an animal model. So there are a lot of advantages, and you know, to these to using these iPS models. And I think for placental disease, we're really just beginning.
You are in a field that I would imagine people who are interested in entering the medical field, it's not one of the top ones people think about. You're in a very specific field. You're doing very specific research. How did you get interested in this in the first place?
That's interesting question. I always knew that I wanted to do a combination of research and you know, combined with some practice of medicine. I really got interested in pathology when I was in medical school. I had really amazing teachers at the University of Virginia that really inspired me. I will tell you that at first, what really intrigued me about pathology was the study of cancer. And I've had a lot of people in my family die of various kinds of cancers. Most recently, I lost an aunt to breast cancer just a few weeks ago. But once I started my residency in pathology, I very quickly found my passion for gynecologic and perinatal pathology. And this came about my sixth month during residency. I was at Emory University, and one of the rotations we do at Emory is at Grady Hospital, which is the county hospital there, where there are a lot of births and therefore a lot of placentas to look at, and also, unfortunately, perinatal autopsies. And so my very first perinatal autopsy was a baby that had died, was late second trimester, this was the mom's ninth loss, I was told, but it was her first loss in the U.S. I think her background was that she was originally from India. So yeah, this was her ninth second trimester loss. And, you know, we did the autopsy, my attending and myself, and didn't find an answer. And I was really, this was before I had a baby, but you know, I was really shook up. And after talking to my attending, he said, well, you know, we're not going to find an answer from the autopsy itself, but, you know, what you need to do is go downstairs and find the placenta. So I did, and I remember when we first looked at this placenta from this baby, it didn't look like a placenta. I had seen placentas, I had processed placentas, but this literally looked like a rock. And when we cut into this placenta is normally a very spongy, bloody organ. This was, you know, it was almost like cutting through fabric. It was so solid. And it turns out that this patient had an autoimmune disease. And by reviewing the placenta, we were able to identify, you know, not only why this particular baby had died, but why she was experiencing so many recurrent losses. So, fortunately for this condition, it's a type of condition where they were able to treat her, and I don't know for sure if she went on to be able to have children, but autoimmune disease is a condition that can be diagnosed by reviewing the placenta, and if given treatment, the woman can actually then go on to have successful future pregnancies. So that was really inspiring for me, and particularly when my attending told me that, you know, there's really a lack of understanding of placental disease, and a perinatal autopsy is really not complete without looking at the placenta. So I became very interested at that time, and it's been a wonderful journey since.
Well, thanks for sharing that. Shifting gears, many people may not see the connection between pregnancy loss, stillbirth, and stem cell research. How does your work help stillbirth and pregnant families?
A large majority of stillbirth is associated with a small placenta and with placental insufficiency. These models that I was talking about, the stem cell models, the iPS models, from patients with various types of placental insufficiency, is really going to allow us to be able to study these conditions in the dish in much more detail and try to understand the various different pathways that are affected in the placenta that lead to these diseases. We have yet to actually derive iPS cells from placentas of stillborn babies, but we plan to do that in the near future. Right now we're focused on, we have iPS cells from placentas, mainly of patients with preeclampsia, those with IUGR, but we're hoping to also, at some point in the near future, derive iPS cells from placentas of stillborn babies as well.
Let's talk about umbilical cord accidents. I know you've studied diagnosis of cord issues in pathology. It's a challenging diagnosis for both providers and families. Can you talk about your work surrounding umbilical cord accidents?
Yeah, sure. So umbilical cord accidents are complicated to diagnose because many babies that are born alive can be born with cords that are wrapped around their necks, or so-called nuchal cords, or with cords that are too long or have a true knot. So when I was doing my fellowship in perinatal pathology in Boston, my mentor, Theonia Boyd, and I did a study where we looked at cases of stillborn babies where we knew the cause of death was a cord accident based on a very detailed autopsy. And we found that by reviewing the placentas from these babies, that there are changes in the placenta that are more often found in placentas of babies that died from cord accidents. So we detailed these in a paper, and now are using these changes in order to diagnose when a baby is stillborn because of cord accidents. These changes all have to do with what happens in the placenta when the baby's blood flow, when the baby's blood flow through the placenta is interrupted. So the placental changes can be used to diagnose cord accidents by evaluating the placenta.
Let's talk about autopsies for a second here. And I know many pregnancy loss families, mine included, when you're at the hospital and you've just been delivered the worst news you've ever heard, and then the next question they ask is, would you like to do an autopsy? And that's a question a lot of people don't expect to have to answer. And a lot of people's perception of autopsies is what they see in Hollywood movies and TV shows. And I know that's probably not all that accurate. What do you say to families, or what is your advice to families who may be concerned about these types of procedures?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely can't imagine how hard that would be. Here, I think what's important for families to know is that there are many, many different ways that autopsies can be done. First and foremost, though, families should know that autopsies are done by pathologists who, across the board, are, you know, highly respectful of the human bodies that they are working on, that they are very also highly respectful of the wishes of the family, and very focused on trying to find the cause of death. You know, they're very they take their jobs very seriously. But there's definitely, and it's specifically for a perinatal autopsy, but even for adult autopsies, I think it's important for people to know that autopsy doesn't have to be a complete autopsy. So there are all different types. There is a kind where no tissue is removed. So one example would just be an external exam only autopsy. And this would include not just the external exam, but it can also, for example, include imaging studies like an X-ray. And this can be very useful, for example, let's say if the cause of death in a baby is suspected to be a form of skeletal dysplasia, which is an abnormal formation of bones. So this type of exam could, even though it's very limited, could be very useful in confirming or excluding such a diagnosis. There are also other ways to limit the autopsy. So for example, we do autopsies where the body is opened, but the head is not, so the brain is not examined. Other limitations that sometimes our patients ask is, for example, if there's only, again, like one organ that was found to have an abnormality. So, for example, we've done heart-only autopsies. Other cases where they were asked to open the body but not to remove the organs and just kind of examine the organs in situ. Or just take biopsies where we need. And so my recommendation is, as difficult as it may be at the time, is for the parents to discuss this with their clinical care provider. And if the clinical care provider is not comfortable, to have that individual reach out to the pathologist and have a discussion with the pathologist as to what the possibilities are. And, you know, this has to be done in consultation. This is best done probably in consultation with the pathologist, because as the pathologist finds out, for example, what the clinical questions are, he or she may be able to make a recommendation as to, you know, what sort of autopsy, how extensive the autopsy would need to be in order to potentially be able to identify the cause of death.
Well, that's fascinating. I think a lot of people wouldn't even know that there are multiple different types of autopsies and that they're not one size fits all, and they can be customized to what's comfortable for you. So piggybacking off of that, when it comes to autopsies and post-mortem testing, for people in the medical community, OBs, midwives, nurses, what would you want them to know about how they can work with pathologists and how pathologists can work with them and how they can be collaborative and work together for these types of incidences?
Yeah, I think that really the most important thing is communication. What I find is that once a clinical care provider, you know, reaches out to me with a question, or a concern that their patient has, you know, we end up from the conversation that we have, we identify what might be the best thing to offer to the parents. So where issues arise in my practice is where I feel like there is a lack of communication up front. So a lot of times at UCSD, what I try to do is to just go around and introduce myself to a lot of people. Here we have a lot of trainees as well. We have a midwife program, so we have, you know, all kinds of individuals that are taking care of our pregnant patients. So I basically, you know, let everybody know that, you know, if you have any questions, if anything comes up before you even approach the patient, if you want to give me a call and, you know, we discuss what the questions are, and then you can approach the patient and, you know, offer these, you know, their options. Or if the patient has a question directly, I've had patients call me in particular, you know, after we've done an autopsy and they have additional questions, but I've had patients also reach out to ask questions about, you know, what would be best to do ahead of time. So I think communication between the patient, the clinical care provider, and the pathologist is really the key to be able to provide the best care in such cases.
Well, Dr. Parast, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for giving us a glimpse inside of your world, and thank you for taking the time to be a guest on our podcast.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.